The sheer volume of open source projects impacting networking has reached near comedic proportions. What started as a small but manageable group of projects devoted to software-defined networking has grown into a plethora of platforms, a cornucopia of consortiums, and a competition of conferences. Which of these open source projects have real momentum behind them, and which ones can be safely ignored, and why, really, do we have so many of the darn things? I'm Ethan Banks, your frequent Packet Pushers host for 6 years now. Greg Farrow is with us also, and joining us to share his insider perspective on what's really happening with open source networking is Carlos Cardenas. Carlos has been a recent contributor to the Packet Pushers community blog, notable for his acerbic wit. Seriously, go read his posts. They are pretty funny. Carlos, welcome to the mic, and please tell the audience something about yourself.
Howdy, what y'all know good? So for those that don't habla, that's kind of my way of breaking the ice. Basically, it means when you add some additional syllables in there, it means what are y'all up to? No good. You know, it's kind of a way to get y'all on your toes, so to speak. So some about myself. Well, born and raised in Texas. So that means I'm really good at three things: burning meat, shooting guns, and riding motorcycles.
Well, yeehaw!
probably with a rather foolish looking hat as well.
Something.
Now, Carlos, you work at Cumulus, but you were telling us before the show that you work at Cumulus, but you're like the only guy that doesn't work for Cumulus in a way.
Yeah. So one of the misconceptions I get from a lot of folks, because they see me and they're like, "Oh, this is just another vendor talking." And so I kind of like to reiterate, Cumulus, I'm a Cumulus employee, you know, Cumulus pays my bills, but my entire job is OCP networking, right? So I am like the only guy at Cumulus that doesn't work on engineering or product or biz dev or anything like that. My entire job is really the OCP networking community.
OCP is in the Open Compute Project.
Correct. So I'm basically, I take more meetings outside of Cumulus than I do inside of Cumulus, which is quite interesting because a lot of these meetings are also, you know, Cumulus competitors. So a lot of trust has to be, both on both ends. You know, they trust me not to spill whatever they're going to contribute to within the Open Compute Project and vice versa. So it's pretty tiresome, man.
Well, one question before we start getting into this conversation about open networking and so on, Carlos. You were born and raised in Texas. What is your take on the size of Texas? Is it big enough?
Oh man, nothing can be big enough. If you've seen me in person, you'll see why. It's like instead of your average stereotypical Texan, right? I'm not like 6'4" and 240. I'm not like a Channing Tatum type thing. I'm like a pygmy. Right? I'm like Tom Cruise size.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, Carlos, we should start off with the why question. Why open source projects from a vendor perspective? Why are vendors throwing so much energy into so many different networking-related open source projects?
Yeah, and this one's kind of, it's both interesting and amusing. It's interesting in the effect that, you know, a lot of vendors realize that customers are demanding things being a little bit more open than what they've done in the past. So, for example, what we've already seen in the server industry where, you know, if I bought a workstation, it came from like IBM or it came from Sun, right? These are really highly engineered boxes designed for a particular purpose. Well, it turns out my administrative assistant doesn't need an IBM or a Sun to be engineered to the hilt. It just needs, you know, basic functionality of, you know, Outlook, web browsing, and that's it. You don't need something as much or as big as what some of these vendors were doing. And they're finally listening to what customers are asking for. And one of the things that's happening in networking is a lot of people don't like the lock-in. And so what's happening is you see a lot of vendors, whether it's something I call open washing, so they'll open source maybe a small piece of their product that really offers no value, or to the extreme of you'll see one company that will just open source their entire product and be more of a support and services, typically like a Red Hat. Why there's so many of them? I mean, that's a good question. It seems like everyone wants to do their own thing. They want to have control of their own destiny. It's like, we want to be open source, but we want to control the community too. History has shown us that doesn't really work. Good example, take a look at Sun when they open source Solaris. They called it Open Solaris. I mean, how many people adopted that? Yeah.
Not well, part the of the conversation
today.
Well, the
reasons for open sourcing are quite complicated. They're not immediately simple. Sometimes, mostly it's because open source is a way to displace incumbent vendors. So for the last 20 years, for example, Cisco's dominated the networking market because it built a moat around its business that meant that people couldn't enter the market and compete with them, right? People couldn't build a network operating system where they couldn't make the silicon. So Cisco made the silicon. Cisco had business models which prevented resellers from having multiple vendors. You know, all sorts of things made it hard for people to enter the market. Open sourcing means that you take away some of the competitive advantages that the incumbent has. You say, here's my platform, it's open. You can come and join my platform at no cost. You get to participate in the process, you get to, and that makes it equally possible at a business level, at a strategic level, to displace long-standing incumbents with products. So it can be a strategic move, not just a, you know, throwing something open to get in, right? It's a strategy, not just a dumb move, you know?
Yes, and in terms of open networking doesn't mean open sourcing. Take a look at Dell. Their switches are not open source, but they are open, right? They run ONI. You can install whatever NOS that supports the platform drivers for that platform and get up and running. If a customer doesn't like it, they can uninstall that NOS and install another one.
Yes. So different definitions of open, right? Now you're talking about, define the word open, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So Dell, as you say, there's Dell's version of open, and then there's Cisco's version of open, which is the API on the operating system's open, except it's behind a password on their website.
Right,
but anyway, whatever.
So what do the vendors get out of backing all of these different projects? We've mentioned Cisco here, and they're very notable for backing all kinds of projects, even projects that compete with each other for functionality, like they got a horse in every race. What as a vendor, what am I getting out of this?
Well, with some things, it's more psychological in nature, right? Everyone wants to be conceived as the thought leader. Everyone wants to be conceived as, oh yeah, that was my idea. We backed it, you know. So essentially, it's like they got two horses in the race. You know, whichever one wins, they're still making money. So you have some of that going on. And in other times, it's the organization or the group is so new or so nebulous, it's not wrong to be part of it as well. Case in point, look at OpenNFV or OpenStack.
Oh, so I mean, do you see OPNFV and OpenStack as competing? Because I see them as somewhat complementary.
Well, I guess I use those two in a vague term. So OpenNFV right now, it's so new, but yet it's so nebulous. Everyone, it's very vogue to be part of an NFV thing. But in reality, if you look at it right now, it's like the main drivers for OpenNFV are the same people that build appliance boxes. And they're being told, it's like, hey, we want like a load balancer, but we don't want to buy your appliance. So what are these guys are doing? Well, they essentially, it's like, okay, well, we're no longer running on a custom ASIC. We need to run our software on some x86. So we'll package our stuff up in a VM. You can deploy us. And, you know, it's a VM that needs like 8 gigs of RAM. You need to set your CPU affinity to 100% on so many cores.
Yep.
And that's it. It's like, well, we didn't gain anything. I mean, that's not OpenNFV. When people tell me it's like, oh yeah, the whole goals of OpenNFV is, you know, you want to be able to horizontally scale out without these minor minutiae. So for example, if I want load balancing, I'm going to bring up as many instances of HA proxy or whatever that I need to get the job done, as opposed to being tied down to someone's VM now.
And I think one of the key things to understand about the benefits of those, like the tools, especially tools like HAProxy, is that developers don't need to buy licenses or trial versions or arcane, you know, handling. A lot up until now, open means people have been able to make a HAProxy work, and so you just go and you grab it, you do a, you know, a curl and fetch it from the command line, or you use Puppet scripts, or, you know, whatever it is that you're going to use, you download it from the appropriate repository and boom, you've got it. Whereas commercial products have a restriction, and it's a competitive disadvantage, in effect, is that licensing, you don't have to download HaProxy, then go and get a key that's related to the proposed volume of traffic that's going to go through it. So open has flexibility in the sense that it doesn't have anything that stops you from using it sometimes. That can also be a pain, of course. Sometimes people use HaProxy when really a load balancer would, you know, or a WAN accelerator or some other technology would be better than, you know, but if you can get something done with HaProxy, guess what? It's a great tool.
Carlos, I look at a lot of these projects, and in my intro, I said comedic because everybody's got some project that definitely overlaps some other project now. Here's an example. One of the ones that threw me was the controllers ODL and ONO. So Open Daylight has been around kind of the longest, I guess, and a ton of people got on board very early. There was a lot of fervor around the first summit. And then a couple years later, roughly, you have ONO show up with a distributed architecture and some different focuses like the cord use case, et cetera. But by and large, if you stand back and look at what ODL and ONOS do, there's a ton of overlap there. And we see that in a lot of other places as well, particularly open networking switch operating systems, depending on what part of the stack, where they play, lots of overlap. Can all these projects last? Are they going to last? What's really going on here?
Yeah, so I guess we'll start with the controllers, right? So it's like, you know, early in the day, you had this thing called Floodlight, and you couldn't just give it away. At some point in time, it's like everyone wanted it. And then at another point in time, it's like you couldn't even give it away. Now we have ODL, and you had all the big players jump on and try to do something with it. And yeah, there was a great amount of interest or momentum early on, but it somehow didn't really go anywhere. And yet, some out of there, we had this thing called the Open Network Operating System, ONOS, which I get a kick out of because it's not an operating system. It's just a Java app.
Right.
and it just, I don't know what it is. I guess Guru really knows how to just, you know, push my buttons on that one. Cause it's like, dude, you get a PhD. It's not an operating system, but it's you know, whatever. I'm trying to get off that tangent here, but yes, it's like, it's just almost the same product, but different people. And I guess they want to have their own control or their own hands in the honeypot, you know, making decisions. And on one hand, it's like, why reinvent the wheel if all you want to do is just have more control of it? I mean, one option could is they could just forked it and done their own thing. But I mean, on some hands, it's kind of like, do we really need a few? I mean, if you look at the open source SDN controllers, there's many of them. Besides Ryu and Floodlight, and now you have ODL and ONOS and those are just the ones that are du jour. I mean, imagine the ones that will be coming out later this year or next year or whatever. So that's kind of
instead of one controller to rule them all, we're ending up with one controller that caters to a particular vendor. I think in some cases it's a controller that caters to a particular end user, like maybe an AT&T that really is looking for certain features and functionality. And so rather than the industry rallying around one controller or sets of controllers, we've just got this, what I would describe as a massive fracturing in the network, in the industry. Then in the long term, I think is bad for consumers because we don't settle on a set of technologies that we can all count on and then begin to move forward with. It's like, I don't know what to bet on. I'm just going to sit back and let the dust settle.
Yes. I mean, there's that. And there's also the fact that, you know, from an end user's perspective, it's whichever horse they back, they're almost guaranteed to lose because none of these controllers interoperate with each other. And that's, no bueno. You know, on the network operating system side, it's we see everyone kind of, fracture on doing their own thing. You know, you have Cumulus that wants to be like a Red Hat. You know, everything is just Linux. You have Big Switch that is basically, they just want their NOS is really like the gateway to their controller. You have like a Pika 8 where everything is inside a shell, you know, very akin to what you're used to with a traditional vendor. And then, of course, you have what Microsoft released or announced they call Azure Cloud Switch, but the thing that they announced was Sonic, which is basically, as I mentioned in my blog post, think of it as a cake mix. You add a Linux distribution to it, and poof, you have a NAS. I guess
the thing about Sonic is just to explain that Sonic is the apps that live on top of an operating system. So Sonic assumes you have an operating system running on your Switch, and then Sonic comes on top. Is that a reasonable description?
At the moment, like, that's essentially what they want it to be. At the moment, it also includes the platform drivers underneath. So, for example, it knows how to blink the lights on the front panel ports, control the fans, the temperature sensors, and the PSUs.
Right. But it's still an app in the same way that Facebook's FBOSS is an app on top of an operating system.
Correct.
And you can take FBOSS. I don't know if they've open sourced the code yet, but the idea behind Facebook's FBOSS is that it's an app that runs on top of the operating system. So Switch system architectures, for if you haven't been keeping up with this, is you have hardware in the box, is fundamentally an OCP switch, is an x86 computer, and then off to the side, instead of a PCI bus, there's an ASIC, usually a Broadcom, but it can be Cavium or some of the others, you know, for tests and so forth. And it'll do 48 ports of 1 gig, 10 gig, 40 gig. It'll do, and some high speed ports. And you put an operating system on there. There's usually an SSD inside. The operating system boots. At that point, it's an x86 computer with a hunk of silicon on the side, sucking power. And then you run the apps, and the apps then are able to program the ASIC exactly the same way as you use an app on a PC, to be honest, in concept. In execution, completely different. But in concept, not too far away. Is that fair? Is that a fair summary?
We're getting pretty close. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to delve too much into the weeds on intricacies on that. But you're pretty much, you know, spot on.
It's a broad swipe. It's a broad swipe, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that's coming, the great thing about the openness, and maybe we'll talk more about this later on, but is because it's fundamentally a computer with an ASIC and an operating system and apps, it means that we can now start to run things like containers and VMs on the Switch, and then we can run stuff in those. So, and that openness, that ability to be open, not be restricted by a vendor who doesn't want to support that or doesn't want to write that code, is, and because we're using standardized components from open, means that we can actually do this. It's something we've never been able to do before or could even imagine.
So in the winners of these open source technologies, it's pretty clear that the winner for this is the Linux kernel, and particularly the networking stack project NetDev, right? That's pretty much common through all the network operating systems, common on most of your servers in the data center, your phones, you know, if you're running Android. I mean, that right there, to me, is like the biggest winner of all the open source projects.
I was watching some videos today from NetDevConf, and they're actually doing some pretty amazing things. I mean, it's not the greatest video production, but the content is there. They're talking about how NetDev can do MPLS and VERFs and a whole bunch of really interesting things. It's not the Linux that you know and understand.
I don't know about the Linux if I know or understand, because I use those features, I would say, almost on a daily basis, just because they're part of the Linux operating system. If I have one of the latest kernels, you know, like a 4.2 or even, you know, Bleeding Edge 4.4. But yeah, I mean, it's all there. It's like I can do my MPLS or VERF with just, you know, IP route 2 commands. Mm. And it's pretty nifty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to, you know, there are videos on YouTube if you're interested in learning more about NetDev. I promise you it's fascinating, but in a very nerdy way. So
we are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronics Training. I can talk about Micronics not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronics customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronics over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharians. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCIE routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronics boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narbik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest but most rewarding 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronics offers several CCIE level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronics offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronicsTraining.com. Micronics is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronicsTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you. Carlos, I want to ask you about vendors versus users or end consumers of the products of open source, if you will. And let's start with this perspective. Vendor involvement in open source projects, that seems to me self-serving, a little bit dangerous, to a point, a bit outside the realm of the spirit of open source, because it's really supposed to be about end-user involvement and so on. And we've seen a lot of the Linux Foundation-based projects start to shut down who can provide input, who can be involved, and so on. It's getting to be, you know, tighter control. Isn't that dangerous, if you will, that the vendors are going to be taking over these projects and it's... Yeah, they're open source, but really it's all about what the vendors want.
Yeah, so speaking of that, I'll just go off on a little tangent real quick with the Linux Foundation. Nothing personally against them, but some of their previous actions just, you know, within the last year or so has been very, very disconcerting in the sense that it's basically they're almost giving control of the foundation, essentially the community, over to the vendors and to the highest bidder. And that's kind of crazy. It's because of the whole purpose of the Linux Foundation was to be about the community, not the vendors with the biggest, donations or contributions, as they would probably say it. And that was just kind of nerve-wracking. Now, back to your point on open sourcing projects, you know, where it's the vendor themselves is kind of controlling the community, that is very dangerous. And it's very dangerous in the sense that you, without open, you know, the whole point of open source is the community. So without a community, like a real community, not a community that's the only people that contribute are the ones that work for your company. You know, take a look at what Sun did with Open Solaris, where pretty much the entire community was Sun employees. You know, that just doesn't go well. And then when it doesn't go well, it's, you just have the project folding. And that is kind of what some of these projects are at risk of, and that's folding. If you don't legitimately have a community, but you open source something, okay, great. Now we'll just go on to the next person that open source something. There's really no added benefit or differentiation at that point. When it comes to open source technologies, really the differentiator besides the technology itself is the community, right? I mean, if you look at FreeBSD, FreeBSD is one hell of an operating system. You know, I used to run it back in the day. One of the reasons for me no longer running it day to day like I do Linux is the community, right? It's got a smaller community. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, is a lot of these people just open source something just to be on the open bandwagon, and now they can have a marketing deck that says, oh yeah, we're open. You know, hand waving, don't look at the hand behind the mirror, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I mean, come back to the strategic piece that I said earlier is, and let's take a slightly different slant on that. There are companies who are not making the progress in the market a little bit. So if you're funding a company with venture capital dollars, a lot of companies are being bet on to get stratospheric growth, like electric growth. So it's not enough for them to spend 10 years building a steady, gradual business model. They're funded that they're either going to go big or go home, kind of thing. And if you're not getting the traction that you wanted with a commercial product, like with a closed source, then throwing it open gives you a chance before your cash runs out, because the if you know what I'm saying, of getting people to come and pay attention to your product.
I think Midacura is an example of someone who's been successful with exactly that strategy.
Yes, and PlumGrid, and Open Contrail, of course, for Juniper is an absolute flag bearer of this. After all, at the OpenStack conference this week, Open Contrail was voted the number one SDN product for OpenStack by some. Anyway, Juniper was, you know, very proudly tweeting that all around the place, and rightly so. You know, Contrail was a closed product. They put it into the open to get people to join onto it, and they've achieved quite a great deal of success doing that as a strategic move. When they first started, I didn't quite make sense of how they were going to build a community and how they were going to get traction with that. But they've certainly managed to do that over a long period. It took 3 or 4 years. You can't expect to just throw your product into the open and then for all these people to go, hey, that's the cool thing. I need to go and spend, you know, 60 hours a week working on that because it's going to take a long time. Open is not a shortcut to market. And I think that's when you get the cloud washing thing or the open washing is when people sort of throw it open and then suddenly expect it to get momentum. You know, Cloud Router, for example, IXP developed a commercial router internally. They open sourced cloudrouter.org. And that's an example of another product where they're hoping that other people will join in. As a strategic move to get the product and then be able to make money off it, sometimes it's about that, not, but the marketing comes off as open washing, I agree. And there is a certain amount of open washing, but.
Well, I think there is a go-to-market strategy here, though, Greg, as well, where some folks are taking a project, it's open, they're behind it, and they're hoping it takes off, and then they're going to offer a commercial version of it, and that's where they're going to make their money. But they were the brains and the engine behind the initial open source product offering. I talked to some folks from Pani Networks who are behind the Romana project, for example. Mm. That's part of their strategy. Romana's open. Here it is. You can use it. Here's what it does. Yeah. And they're going to have a commercial offering of it eventually.
It's a very cost-effective way of selling a product to a market. You don't need to put salespeople on planes and pre-sales engineers whoring themselves on conferences and desperate to speak, you know, evangelists. God, I hate that term, evangelists. I despise everything about evangelists. But, you know, you don't have to hire, and those people are expensive. They don't, you know, not only does it cost $200,000 a year to keep them paid, it also costs another $250,000 a year to put them on planes and hotels. Right, it's expensive to promote your product around the place and to get salespeople out there to ask for the order. It's a lot easier. There's another sales strategy which says, I'll open source my product and build a community. People will come. And then there's my target market right there in the open community that's built its, you know, that's required different sort of investment. Community managers, you know, support, time and resources from your company to participate in the community. But it replaces an expensive sales effort and managers and a lot of hidden costs in terms of travel and expenses and conferences and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that efficiency is what's very key to the technology market. Sort of the thing that I'm beginning to realize is if you can take the costs of sales away, so most of us are used to a white glove sales model. That is, the sales rep comes out, he knows your name, he knows you've married and when your birthday is, and he's your friend and he tries to find things that you share an interest, and he's got access to secret information, so you have to talk to the sales rep and his pre-sales engineering team, and they do handcrafted pricing just for you because it's not a commodity product, because it is, even though it is. It's like, you know, when you go down to the Rolls-Royce dealership, guess what you get? Exactly that treatment, that white glove, high quality treatment. But there's a price attached to that. And if you're buying those products, something like 25% of your product price is caught up in the sales process that you just experienced, that face-to-face, boots on the ground, bums in planes, you know, all that stuff. Whereas open communities bypass all that cost and all that fuss and all that annoyance. I mean, it's an embuggerance in the modern era to sit down with a salesperson for meeting after meeting. Do you know there's a strategy in sales to just keep you in meetings so that you don't go anywhere else?
It reminds me of the South Park episode when the boys go to Aspen.
I don't know that one. Tell me.
Yeah. So the boys go to Aspen, you know, one of the parents like, oh yeah, we got this timeshare. It's a free stay. We can go skiing and see what we like. So they go, basically the parents get locked up in this room with the timeshare salesmen's. And, you know, the boys get stuck with like an 80s montage of, you know, pick a random 80s movie where you got the bully challenging guy and you got to save the community center or whatever. So, yeah.
I mean, those open source is a way of avoiding that embuggerance. Now, you might build a sales force. Look at what Cisco's done I guess if I consider what Cisco's done with the Open Daylight, they contribute a lot of the code. They still contribute the bulk of code today, as I understand it. They're not dropped off their commitment to Open Daylight in a lot of ways. But they also have a commercial version of that. But at the same time, it's very confusing. They also have ACI, they have Epic EM, they have VTS for the service provider market. They have, you know, there's several other SDN projects inside of Cisco that make it very confusing to see the open separate from the closed, separate from the things that sit in the middle. So when we say open, I think I'm learning slowly and the hard way, and my opinions on this are changing over time, that there is a time when you want the, you know, the Rolls-Royce sales, the white glove, the customized service. And to me, that dates back to a day in the 1970s. I can remember, say, back in the late 80s and the early 90s when buying a microcomputer was a once-in-a-decade, maybe once-in-two-decades opportunity. Literally, you went to your company. I can remember sitting down with the CEO, and he was meeting with the bank to get his financing for his microcomputer. This was one of the biggest decisions he was going to make for his company in the next 20 years. And he would buy that computer, and then they were locked into that for decades because they had a five-year finance or 10-year finance series. Do you remember that? Anybody remember that? No, maybe it's just me.
It was always a big expense. I don't know if it was so big you had to finance it typically, but I remember it being a $2,000 to $5,000 expense depending on how fancy you got.
I can remember it being $250,000 to $500,000. Expense.
Oh, those were Australian dollars. Those don't even. Yeah, those aren't real.
But I mean, you're literally talking like $4 to $5 million. You're talking about, you know, but the costs worked. But it was such an enormous decision, and so you wanted the white glove sales model. Whereas now we actually fund computer purchases out of cash flow. It's just overhead.
Hey, Carlos, I want to go back to your comments on community earlier. You were stressing the importance of it. You made the point that, hey, I used to use FreeBSD, but the Linux community is better, not as much going on in FreeBSD. Define community. What does that mean to you?
Community, it's not only the core committers, you know, the core people that are contributing code, but it's also the people doing some of the more mundane things, whether it's documentation, whether it's you know, building products on top of that, whether it's, you know, some conferences or some, not to use Greg's favorite word, evangelizing. it's basically, it's kind of like when you combine all of that, that's kind of what from a company or an end user's perspective, you know, that's kind of what you want. It's that feel good of, yes, I am going to this open source project and it has this community. So if I have a problem, I can always go to, you know, the community and find the people that work on this, you know, like the services market. Or if I want a product based on this, I can go to a variety of different people that are going to not only support me, but support the products I buy.
And where do you find these people? We talk about IRC, we talk about forum sites. Where are you going to interact?
Yeah, so I guess I was going to say, back in the day, it's kind of like the hardcore folks, that's all IRC, right? I mean, they live and die on that command line with IRC.
It still is, yeah.
And still is. Nowadays, it seems that not only is it IRC, mailing list, then, of course, you got the rise in Slack, and then I guess in the last several years, it's basically, we're going to have conferences every month, which is quite expensive.
Yeah, we get invited to conferences fairly often. In fact, I think if we wanted to, we could be on a plane 2-3 times a month going off to some conference or another tied to open source. I mean, it's everybody's got to have their conference now, and you're going to have 800 to 1,000 people show up, and there's going to be a keynote, and there'll be music and dancing bears and nerd sessions way off in the corner where some code committer is talking about the whatever bit of project he's working on and so on. There is community there, but again, a lot of these that I've been to seem to be vendor-driven as much as not. But you're tied up with the Open Compute Project, which I think of as more end-user-driven. Is that a fair conception about Open Compute?
I mean, it is, just because that was kind of like the whole mantra of why it got started, you know, from the beginning with, you know, from Facebook as an end-user. What I see it as, it's more of we have like an equal sitting at the table for vendors, end users, and individuals. And that's kind of different when you compare it to other organizations. So, for example, you can take a look at, you know, ONF, when it was originally started, basically you have the academics on the pedestal and everyone else was at the kiddie table. And you go to ONUG, and it's essentially it's the quote-unquote decision makers and people with the purses, and everyone else is at the kiddie table. And so what you get there is a lot of pandering one way or the other. So in the ONUG sense, you have everyone doing the open washing, you know, pay-to-play thing, where essentially I pay my $1,500 or $2,000 to attend, and now I get a speaking slot, and I can basically talk about SD-WAN, but it's really just a sales pitch for my product. And ONF, it's like, you know, you do the same thing, but it's from an academic perspective. It's like, yeah, this is really cool from an academic perspective.
I can see your point of view about ONUG, and there are certain aspects of that, but everything costs money, and we have to pay for them somehow. So even though, I mean, I'd love to participate in more open projects, but I don't have a corporate sugar daddy who's going to pay for me to go.
Oh, man, I wish I had a corporate sugar daddy so I can go to these ONUGs.
Yeah. Well, you
I
know,
hear they have some awesome dinners, yeah.
Yeah. But not just, I mean, all of the conferences, right? There is so many of them. And one of the things that I'm beginning to realize is you can actually just do it from home. Attending the conference is not necessarily the most efficient use of your time. I'm sort of changing topics a little bit. But one of the great things about open, in that if you want to dig into it that way, is that you don't actually have to be in the money to do it. Most of the time they publish this stuff and make it available for everybody.
That's right. So that's one of the things, you know, as I mentioned, you know, within the Open Compute Project, we pride ourselves, everyone has an equal sitting. So, all the meeting minutes, all the meetings happen virtually. So you don't actually have to live in a particular part of the country like the Bay Area to be a participant, right? You can be anywhere. You know, we have folks in Asia and Europe constantly on our calls, among elsewhere.
For OCP, Carlos, I just want to interject here. There seems to be an attitude of that of exactly what you're saying, where everybody's getting equal standing. And I say that from having attended a meeting that was held, just happened to be about an hour away from where I live up here in New Hampshire at UNH. So I went over to UNH to sit in and just kind of observe what was going on. And it was back and forth between people making silicon, people who were switch manufacturers. I was sitting in a discussion about whether or not they should put two management ports on a switch chassis, the cost trade-offs versus the operational benefit, and everybody was throwing it around. Manufacturers, the vendor that was going to make the thing, the end users that were going to consume it, what their use case was, and it did seem exactly what you're describing, very open. Everyone had a voice and was able to share, which I thought was pretty notable as I sat there in the back and watched what was going on.
Yeah, so you were there back in summer of 2014. July of 2014.
It sounds about right, yeah.
So that was an interesting meeting right there because, I mean, that's pretty, you know, I say interesting because a couple things were the buds that came out of that. One was the OCP networking interop program and also the switch abstraction interface.
Program was announced right there. I remember that now, yeah.
They were both seated there. But, you know, what you described is very common in our meetings. Both the physical ones that we have, like what we call in engineering workshops, but also even in our virtual ones that we hold every month. I mean, that's pretty much what we have, and it's that openness. It's like when we had I don't want to mention that vendor that was saying that. It's like, why the hell do I want two management ports? I just want one, and it should be in the front, not the back. And the manufacturer is like, well, yeah, we could do that, but for the way this board's laid out, we have to run some additional traces or whatever, and. You know,
it's going to cost you X. It was a dollar discussion. Yeah.
Yes. And, and that was pretty interesting. And next, you know, a few months later, they had that box. And a few months later after that, it was contributed to OCP. So it's pretty interesting on how things matriculate just based on when people actually sit down and consider themselves to be equal.
Well, and there's mutual benefit there, right? You've got people trying to sell equipment who are selling to members of OCP who want the devices manufactured to a particular standard so that it can be produced en masse so that they can buy it by the pallet load and get it deeply discounted and put it in their data centers. So it's in everybody's best interest to come to terms on that thing.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, you have the folks that, you know, the mom and pops and such that I use, that term kind of loosely, that want the same thing. It's like they have limited cash flow or limited operational expenditures. You know, they can't hire another dedicated network person. They want to use the same stuff that either Facebook or Apple or Verizon or whatever is using. And so we've seen some of those folks that are like, yep, we'll buy the same switch and we'll deploy the same software because we know that's what the big guys are running and we can save some serious money. And we've actually seen that work for them. A good example is there's actually some police departments and churches you wouldn't believe that are actually on open networking hardware and software.
Let me ask you a question about reliability and open. One of the questions that I most often get thrown at me is whether or not the white box is reliable. And a lot of the times the competitive vendors are talking about whether something is reliable enough to be used, you know, in real life. Do we have any statistics about the reliability of white box?
Yeah, so typically when people mention that, the first thing I say is BS, but I typically spell it out. and I typically would say that in my Texan accent as I strut my boots and my buckle. And I tell them, be careful what you're stepping in because you're going to get your pants dirty. but essentially, what I tell people after I do that introduction of the ice breaking and whatnot is, you know, these vendors, they don't make their own boxes. They go to ODMs, you know. So it's those same ODMs are actually the ones producing the same boxes for white boxes, whether it's to another OEM or directly to the consumer. So when people talk about, oh, it's not the same or the reliability is different, it's like, how? A good case is in HP, for the last 26 years, all their switches have been manufactured by Acton.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, if I buy the HP switch or the Acton switch, are you going to tell me...
Not all of them. Some of them have. I mean, some of the H3C stuff wasn't. And some of the ProCurve stuff was manufactured in America.
Yes, yeah, yeah. If it wasn't them, it was another ODM for the other pieces.
Yes.
But essentially, it's kind of like, what does it matter if I have, you know, the paint or the lipstick that I call it, the front bezel and then the badge? It's like the hardware's still the same. What people would probably talk about reliability, and the only level of reliability that actually comes into play here is support. It's, do you get the support that you want from the original vendor that you're going for, and will you get the same thing with the new vendor that you're going with in terms of open networking? In the early days, for a lot of times, that was a little harder for like your standard enterprises. Now, in the last couple of years, that's pretty much a non-issue because I can buy all of that through a system integrator, whether it's Dell or Mellanox or HP or Supermicro.
Well, that's one side of it where you can buy that support now for a lot of these open products. But the irony is, even if you're buying, you know, legacy traditional networking hardware and again buying a support contract with it, that support tends to be bloody awful. And this is not a new problem and it's not being solved. I was on a chat yesterday that's filled with network engineers complaining about the misery they have every time they have to call in a bug because of how feeble support is and how difficult it is to come to a resolution. So that's the other side of that coin is how good do you think that name brand support is anyway?
Mm-hmm. I think vendor support's slipping a lot over time. Like the drive to save money, the commodity, like the fact that everything's getting cheaper means that investing in tech support is getting correspondingly harder. It's eroding the ability of vendors to deliver, you know, high quality technical support, I think. That would be my thesis.
The irony is then you if we're banking on, you know, the big names to have great support and that's going to carry us through a tough day, is it really all that? Because you could, from an open source perspective, go to the community or go to that third party that's going to give you the support and hopefully get at least what you would have gotten with quote unquote name brand support or even better in some cases.
Now, there's also backing off of risk. So a lot of companies will back off their support contracts to a named company because then they get legal liability. So there's a legal issue where a support contract with a vendor like Cisco will result in an ability to sue them if something goes wrong. I've never actually seen that stick, to be honest with you.
But you mean I've got a body, that throat to choke in a litigation sense?
Yes, that's right. And yeah. I know companies who say we only do that because that's our company policy, is that's the way we do business. And I find that quite honestly extraordinary because you've never been able to make it stick. I've never seen a successful lawsuit make that sort of stuff stick.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see. Carlos, this is a question I want us to close out the show with here, which is this. We opened up kind of, I was whining a bit about just how many projects there are and how much overlap there is and the competing interests and so on. And so let's close by talking about how the heck do we as end users figure out what horse to back? What is the right project? How do we know what's going to make it and what's not before we invest too much time and energy into A, learning, or B, actually putting some of this code into our infrastructures?
Well, yeah, that's the billion-dollar question right there.
Get out your crystal ball, my friend.
Right. Busting out the crystal ball. A lot of that starts out with the end user trying to, one is just educate themselves on what problem are they trying to solve? We have some end users that they don't understand the problem set as much as the solution. Like, the old cliche of I have a hammer and everything looks like a nail type syndrome. Granted, that's kind of hard for the end user because they don't always have that. And it's very hard to trust a third party, whether it's a vendor or not, to provide that kind of insight. So again, as you peer into this crystal ball, it's really what it's going to come down to is one, the community, that the level of comfortability. Two, whether that community addresses the problem that you have indicated that you need to solve. And three is, are there people there to help you solve it if you can't solve it yourself?
I want to come back to the point about hardware reliability just for a minute. Something struck me. When you say that there are the factories that make the kit for named brand vendors are the same factories that make the white box, I agree with you. I think that's true. The flip side of this is that it is possible for people to make switches with substandard components. So I'm thinking second grade power supplies or fans that don't extract enough, draw enough air and take away the thermal capacity, or the fans are fine, but they're not actually designed to do things. There are things that name brand vendors theoretically do to their switches to make them hardware more reliable. Is that a fair criticism?
Yes and no, and I'll counter at with some really discreet examples, removing vendor names. So when it comes to switches, what some manufacturers do, and you got to be, I'll just preface this. I'm going to talk really slowly because I'm filtering this on the fly.
We need to be careful here.
Right. So it's what some manufacturers do in order to save cost is they build or design or however way you want to put this, substandard I2C buses. And where this comes into play is basically how you accessing the ports, the GPIOs and the pins that make the lights blink and do proper link up, link down, and module insertions and whatnot. And what we've seen is one manufacturer that, an ODM, will build a box one way, and with a good majority of the optics out there, or even, I'll just say modules because it's both cables and optics, will just work. right? Everything just works. But when that box, that same box, is being sold to an OEM, and this ODM wants to make the box a little bit cheaper, they basically redo that I2C bus a little bit. Just a tweak. Or change the CPLDs just a little bit. And when they do that with the, quote, value add, that's when we have some serious problems. Because now, a majority of those cables and optics now have issues because of, you know, the new bus system. And you wouldn't believe how many times this happens. And it is a huge pain point. So, yes, it is true that this does happen. So I do see some people concern on that. But what we've seen is where someone takes like an open design and they do value add on that. And they sell it as an inspired design. We actually see them mess up a little bit. And where we also seen some interesting things is also in the cable and optics is, you know, before we had the interop program, it was like the Wild Wild West. I mean, we had, you know, a lot of folks not adhering to the standards. You know, they're standards compliant, but not really. and it that's exactly kind of what it was. It was just the Wild West. You know, sometimes the cages weren't consistently manufactured to the same spec. Or, you know, last year and or the last 12 to 14 months, like copper's been pretty hard to get in certain places in the world. So people are just buying copper anywhere and everywhere they can get. And by doing that, we actually started seeing some substandard parts come out. And this really impacted the cable market. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, don't do that.
But interoperability testing, you mean like what UNH Interoperability Lab does, that kind of thing, or other stuff?
Well, not only that. So in OCP, we partnered with UNH Interoperability Lab to help us run it. I mean, they have the best and most trusted name doing network interop testing. So what we do is basically it's you take a switch, an open switch, I should say, the open meaning it has ONI running on it so I can install and uninstall whatever NOS I want. I take a given module and I take a given NOS and I run a min spec, a minimum test suite, to ensure that they properly interoperate with one another. And then you just iterate through all that. And from there, it's like we have actually seen some of these issues like come to light. And we've actually seen some of these vendors go back and like, yeah, we're going to fix that right now. And because basically they caught a problem before it got bigger. And so we've seen that as not only shine some light to this problem, but also folks actually having a vested interest in fixing it. Because, you know, that's their reputation on the line. And
that's right.
They want to make sure if they're going to get out of the OEM branding limelight and back into the limelight, like I'm going to sell it as my brand, then they're going to protect it. And so we've actually seen that happen in the betterment for the end users.
I think the attraction here is just the amount of profit to be made selling network equipment. I just wonder if people realize just how vast it is. Something like 80% or more of the actual sale price is raw profit. Even if you know, not including sales costs, as I talked about before, sales cost. You know, the actual price of a switch that actually gets into your pocket is, you know, the hardware items that you're buying is 95%, is only 5% of the purchase price, if that, especially for a simple 1RU switch. You are, of course, paying some money for the software. You're paying some profit margin to the vendor. But even so, the profit margin on some of those, you know, 48-port 1-gig switches is well in excess of 90% gross margin, like gross profit back to the vendor. The attraction is, of course, is that this then means that there are other people who make stuff for a living are saying, you mean I could sell my switches and make 100% markup? You know, if I make a switch for $500, I can go and sell it for $1,000. That's like way better than making Android phone knockoffs. <laughs> You know? <laughs> Why don't I do a production run of those and just ship them into the market? And this is where the concern comes in for the, you know, I'm a big fan of white box, but one of the things that I am concerned about is we'll start to see this shipping of substandard products, as we do in many other markets, right? This is the manufacturing phenomenon is I can get second-rate power supplies and second-rate CPUs and memory that isn't quite in spec or tolerance that might have gone into the skip, but they'll throw them out anyway. And, you know, that is a risk, I think. And the attraction for the people who make these things is that there's just so much profit in getting that stuff to market, one, because there's so much money to be made.
Oh, most definitely. It's like, I'm sure you probably read my post on the whole optic pricing, price gouging that some vendors are notorious for, where they basically take a $100 optic and MSRP that to a grand.
Yes.
and that's standard practice. And it's been standard practice for a long time.
I've been working with an ODM company on SFPs, and they said they have a really simple model for pricing it. They just sell them for half of whatever the vendors are selling them for, and they still make an 80% margin.
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous. Yes.
So how they price their product, they don't have to worry about sampling the market or blah, blah, blah. They just go and get the vendors, work out what they're selling them for, pick a number, half of that, and then sell them to the market, and they're still making money hand over fist. And I was talking to me, just went, he showed me the numbers, and I was like, heck, I'm in the wrong business, man. It's like, it's Las Vegas money. And he's going, yeah, I know.
Well, Carlos, as we wind down the show, thanks for taking the time to come on Packet Pushers today. We know you're social and you write and stuff, so share that with folks. How can they follow you?
Yeah, so I'm on the Twitters for as long as the Twitter is still a thing and Wall Street doesn't shut it down. You can hit me up, Cobra Commander. It's on the blog post and whatnot. I was a big G.I. Joe fan, so that explains why the Cobra Commander thing was there. On the blogs, typically I blog would be on Packet Pushers themselves, just because unless you want to read something formal and canned, coming from the OCP Foundation, that's really the only time I'm blogging there is when I'm announcing something officially from the networking project. Probably some of y'all probably may or may not believe I'm kind of like an introvert at heart. So typically it's, email is fine. If you want to see me, it's the OCP networking project engineering workshops. If you want to see me personally, if you want to hear me talk once a month, we have the OCP networking project calls. It's always on the second Monday of the month. And, of course, you can always find out more information about OCP networking there at the given link, opencompute.org, and then you can view the networking group from the wiki page and see exactly how short I am.
Well, and Greg, how can people follow you?
They can find me on my blog at etheriummind.com and on the Twitter is at etheriummind.
And I am Ethan Banks. At EC Banks on Twitter, ethancbanks.com is my blog. And of course, you can find Greg and I even more at packetpushers.net. And hey, thanks for listening to Packet Pushers today. Now, go tell your boss how extraordinary she is, all the while being very sure not to break wind in her cube. You can find this and many more free technical podcasts for engineers, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can like us on Facebook. And please rate us on iTunes. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.